Plant on the line. This is the commentary.ca. Rona Maynard joins me now to discuss her book, surprisingly her first, My Mother's Daughter, a Memoir. It's a candid and absorbing book about the struggles of being a daughter, a sister, and a mother. From her mother's giant shadow, she being the noted writer Fredell Maynard, her father's alcoholism, and the struggle of being called a bad parent by her son's teacher to battling chronic depression, my next guest, the former editor of Chatelaine, spares little. The book is published by McClelland & Stewart and retails for $34.99. Her website is at www.ronamaynard.com and definitely worth a visit. I am pleased to welcome Rona Maynard to the Plant on the Line program. Good morning, Ms. Maynard.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. Who was Fredell Bruiser Maynard?
She was the pride and joy of Jewish immigrant parents from Russia. They had been fleeing oppression in the old country, and she was the first to obtain an education in the New World. They had such high hopes for her, and she for herself. She was a brilliant student, burning with ambition. She had a photographic memory in addition to her brilliance. Her mind contained vast swaths of English poetry. She had every reason to believe that she was going to be a professor in a university, but that dream was nipped in the bud early on by the barriers of that time. She lost her job when she was pregnant with me, cobbled together another career as a writer over a very long period of time, and eventually she became really successful at that. She published a number of books, including the memoir Raisins and Almonds, which became a Canadian classic. But you don't get over the shame and the shock of losing a job that you deserve to a less qualified person, who in her case was, of course, a man.
There's a photo of her in the back, and it's of you and her in 1986. And having known little about her, and not even having read the book yet, you look at the photo, and she seems larger than life. She's got this, she's holding a glass of water, and she's got such flair when she's holding it. She's listening to you. She seems very interested in whatever you're trying to say, and she's dressed just to the nines.
Yes, I know exactly which picture you mean. She's got a huge hat and a shiny silk dress and a brilliant shade of indigo and an enormous clanking silver bracelet that she brought back from her travels. And although I'm the one who's doing the speaking in the photograph, I find her the more dominating presence in it. Maybe I just say that because that's how I felt at the time. She was the kind of person who walks into a room and heads turn and everybody says, "Who is that woman?" She's the kind of person who once hosted a cocktail party for 100 men. Because she asked herself, well, who are the 100 sexiest, most accomplished, and interesting men in Toronto, and I'm just going to invite them all over. And she didn't know these men in three-quarters of the cases. And I remember thinking, oh, mother, don't never come. You're going to be so embarrassed. And you know something? She filled her house because everybody was so curious to meet the woman who would do this.
You know, you were, it's funny how you talk about, in the book, about trying to get away from that, her dominating shadow. But at the same time, if you just look at the parallels, your lives are similar in the sense that you're both writers.
Yes.
And you both achieved some notoriety in this country. Do you think she resented your success?
She did not have a chance to resent my success. I think she was, resentment is maybe a little too strong a word in any case. I think she felt a little bit of jealousy at seeing me ensconced in an office with my name on the door and an assistant outside. Now, this was at Flair magazine back in the late 70s. And the truth is, I was underpaid, and I shared that assistant with the whole office. But my mom never got to that point, and I think it burned just a bit. I do recall her being much more visibly chagrined when my sister Joyce, at the age of 19, became a literary sensation and got a very lucrative book deal from a New York publisher. And my mother had at that point recently published Raisins and Almonds. She had been working away on it for years in between all her other responsibilities, cooking for the family, hosting my father's university colleagues, writing magazine articles to pay some bills. And she was so proud of this book. It had been praised by Margaret Lawrence, and she's upstaged by her own daughter.
I want to go into the relationship that you had with your mother. There's a story in the book you talk about, I don't know how old you were, I can't remember now, but you had had some beads of some sort, a necklace?
Yes.
And she'd asked you for it, and what was the because I think that speaks volumes about the relationship.
I will explain that story. She had taken my sister and me to Mexico, a country that fascinated her, where we'd been loading up on all kinds of interesting handicrafts, including colored beads. And my mother had bought twice as many of these things as either Joyce or me. One day, she saw me wearing my favorite string of Mexican beads, and she said, "Those are beautiful beads, Rona. Would you give them to me?" And I said, "No, Mother, you have your own beads." And she began to get really testy, and she said, "After all I've done for you, couldn't you at least do one thing for me? Is it so much to ask?" And at that point, I rolled my eyes, which is something I did a lot in those days. I would have been about 16 years old. And I said, "Okay, take them," just because I was afraid I would never hear the end of it if I didn't give her the beads. And she threw them back at me and said, "Keep your precious beads. They're treif. Treif is Yiddish for unclean, and I would not touch them now." I was so angry at the time. I did not understand it. Now I feel that even though she was wrong to do that, I can understand why she did. She was a woman who poured hours and hours of her time into making other people happy, which was supposed to be a woman's number one job in the 50s and early 60s. And I did not appreciate this. So she sometimes, I think, just got very resentful and couldn't help but lashing out and demanding her due. A lot of women felt that way. This was just a few years after Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique.
Have you in your life felt the same way? You have a son.
I do have a son, and I have never felt quite the same way.
Is it a generational thing, do you think?
Yes. Well, first of all, he was a boy, so I never felt I knew what was going on in his head, and I never felt that he needed me to go to the ballet with him and do research on 18th century, on the history of costume, or all these girl things that took up so much time. And also, by the time Benjamin was born, it was no longer expected in the same way that a woman was just going to sacrifice herself, body and soul, to be a mom. So I belong to that generation of women who were so busy furthering their careers, so full of ambition to climb the corporate ladder. We really believed that it could be climbed one rung at a time with no falls or missteps, that we just didn't do much on the domestic side. Yeah, we had to we had to make dinner, we had to do the laundry, but there was none of this judging a woman by who has the whiter white. I still remember those ridiculous laundry commercials from the June Cleaver days.
Had your mother lived in another time, do you think she would have been perhaps more well-known, more successful, and do you think she would have gotten to live this, the life that she wanted?
Absolutely. I think that if she were in her prime today, not only would she be in a university, but she'd have a very senior position. She'd probably be the head of the department, and she would be traveling all over speaking, and she might still be a writer. No doubt she would have taken up writing, but it would not have been a consolation prize. The writing would have been in addition to the teaching. My mother once said, "I could live without writing, but I cannot imagine a life without teaching." She came alive in the classroom, and I was privileged at the age of 12 or 13 to watch her teach a night school course to airmen at the local air base. These were people who had never had the opportunity to get a university education. They had a lot of life experience, but not a lot of book learning. And my mother strode down the aisles quoting poetry, asking challenging questions. She told stories. She told jokes. She was in complete command of that room. And she had all these young guys utterly in her thrall. And me, too. I was so jaded about my mother at that time. And I remember walking out of the classroom and just saying, "You were amazing." Now, early teenage girls and preteen girls are not in the habit of telling their mom, "You're amazing."
Right. Yeah. Your sister's relationship with your mother, was it much the same?
It was very different. My parents had an extremely difficult marriage. My father was an alcoholic, a man of abundant gifts and charisma to burn, but he was drunk most nights. My sister was the pleaser and the placator in the family. She was the one who took it on herself to divert our parents when they were down by staging shows in the living room and making them laugh, and by jumping into their laps and telling them how wonderful they were. And this often happens in a family where there's a deeply embarrassing and painful secret, such as alcoholism, that one child really parents the parent and becomes the caretaker. My sister also poured a lot of bottles down the sink. I never did that. My role in the family was to be the truth teller, and I was always the one who would ask my mother, "Well, why is Daddy such a pain?" Basically, I would complain about him, and She would always say, of course, she never discussed the fact that he was an alcoholic. "He's a brilliant, original man, and you are so lucky to have a father like him."
Your father was an artist?
An artist with deep roots in B.C. He grew up on Vancouver Island in Victoria, the son of British missionary parents, and they didn't have any truck with art, so he broke with them. Emily Carr was a mentor of my dad's. He used to teach at Lampson Street School in Esquimalt, and Emily would pull up outside the car, outside the school in her car to pick up Mr. Maynard and take him sketching. And I've met some of the kids, well, they're not kids, they're elderly, who were in my father's elementary class at Lampson Street, and they just thought it was so exciting that a woman drove a car. They had never seen such a thing in their lives. They had no idea who Emily Carr was or that she was going to be famous.
How did your mom and dad meet?
They met at the University of Manitoba, where my mother was the wunderkind. She was only 19 years old. She was already in second or third year, I believe. And my father was then teaching there. And he also had his own program on CBC. He had a wonderful voice. He was a famous lady killer. And the head of the department needed to find him a marker who was going to be studious enough not to be distracted by the famous, or I should say infamous, Maynard charms. So he picked my mother, and they very quickly fell in love. It was a scandalous relationship because my mother's parents were, my mother was Jewish, and her parents did not want her marrying out. They cried, they wheedled, they threatened heart attacks. They said, "He'll call you a dirty Jew." And she sat on the fence for 6 or 7 years, hoping that a suitable Jewish man would come whom she could love just as much as she loved Max Maynard, but it was not to be. And I think what just mesmerized her about Max was that he truly was a figure from another world, the world of art and the imagination, which was where she wanted to dwell. And here she was in this homely little dress that her mother had made, and her ankle socks, and her lunch in a bag, and her big eyes so full of hunger for learning, and she couldn't resist, He sang to her, he wrote poetry to her. There were early signs that all was not well. Sometimes she would talk on the phone to him at night, and his voice would just disappear. And what had happened was that he had passed out from drinking. And she didn't know that, and he'd make up some excuse, which she would believe being young and naive.
He taught at university. He was an artist, but from what I gather from reading the book, he wasn't as renowned or well-known as an artist until after his death. Is that correct?
Well, he actually had two great periods as an artist. One was as a young man in Victoria, where he was part of a group of young artists that also included Jack Shadbolt. Those two were friends. And he used to say, "I'm going to be the most famous painter in Canada," but he did not persist. He didn't have the mental focus. Drinking will often rob a person of that. He became an academic, but he never finished his graduate training. So The best job he could get was lowliest professor at the University of New Hampshire. He was quite a powerful presence in the classroom, but strictly speaking, he was not qualified. After my parents broke up, after my mother finally threw him out, he went back to Victoria, and he picked up where he left off. He began to paint lyrically beautiful pieces in old age, and he was represented by a couple of good galleries. He started selling his work. He was represented in a number of collections and became something of a star in BC landscape art. He still is represented by the Winchester Gallery in Victoria, and they had a posthumous show of his work a few years ago. There's also quite a bit of his work available online for viewing at the Provincial Archives of BC.
There's a moment in the book where it's at a show, and your mother was invited to speak, and you were there.
Yes, a posthumous show.
Yeah, and there was a moment in there where she was giving a speech, great speech from what I read.
Mm-hmm.
And at first you were sort of apprehensive at her speaking, and then she does something in that speech, and your eyes meet, you write.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened there?
Well, just to backtrack a little, I guess in a way I thought it was kind of inappropriate for my mother, who had thrown my father out, to be appearing in the role of the widow and the keeper of the flame. But that's what she did, and she read a poem that reminded her of my dad. And when she started to read, she was very much in control. She was wearing one of her beautiful long gowns and all her silver jewelry and really in her element. And then as she got into the poem, her voice broke and tears came to her eyes. She was no longer in control. That's when our eyes met. And that's when I knew that a part of her still loved a part of him. He was the man who had thrown open to her the gateway to the imagination, and she was going to love that forever. By this time, she had another love who really made her happy, who devoted himself to pleasing her and giving her silk lingerie and flowers and first-class travel to amazing destinations. He thought she was sexy as well as fascinating and smart. And my father was not that way. He was not a very sexual being. But this man did not give her what my father gave her. So in the course of her life as a woman, she got everything a man could give a woman, but she didn't get it all from the same man.
Back to your father's alcoholism for just a sec. Do you think that he was depressed?
He certainly was depressed.
Do you think that had something to do, because you talk about this in the book, that you'd battled depression yourself. Do you think, I hate to put it this way, do you think you got some of that from him?
Well, I've often asked myself, could this be partly genetic? We now know that a susceptibility to alcoholism can be inherited. But I think that my depression was primarily the result of growing up in a very unhappy, fraught home where I had to button my lip at all times and just could not be myself. I was greatly loved, but I also felt great pressure not to make too much trouble for my parents because they had enough trouble already. My father certainly couldn't be himself as a child either. He was drawn to the arts from an early age, and his parents thought the arts were the devil's work. His mother put the fear of God into him. Every morning she led the family in prayer with just horrific images. And from what I gather, when that woman preached, you could practically smell burning flesh. My father never said this to me. He was very tight-lipped and wouldn't say a negative word about his parents, but I was able to speak with his younger foster brother, and that's how I learned what a frightening effect she could have.
I went to your sister's website, and she's got a piece on there talking about your relationship and this book coming out. She implies in the book that your relationship on her website. That your relationship with her has been challenging.
It indeed has been challenging.
You talk about that in the book. You're obviously you all get along now, and you have.
Yes, we've as they say, done a lot of work on ourselves, and we're in a much more comfortable place now as individuals and as. And as sisters, and what really went wrong between us is that it had to do with the family dynamics. It had to do with her being so damn cute and adorable and pleasing to our parents, and my being so not. My being the family cloud, the one who could always see a problem in every situation. Because she made them happy and I did not make them happy, I used to be very jealous of her, and it's really only in adult life that I've come to see that if not for my sister's presence, I would have been a much bigger disappointment to my parents. Because they would have wanted that cheer and loyalty and Team Maynard stuff from me that I just couldn't give. I'm temperamentally not that kind of gal. I'm more grave, I'm more aloof, and I need a lot more time to myself. So really, she made it a lot easier for me to be me, but only an adult can see that. So I was often being compared negatively to her. And in some ways, she was compared negatively to me. Our mother used to say, Joyce is a liar, and Rona, Joyce always lies, Joyce exaggerates, Joyce is untrustworthy, Joyce is impulsive, and Rona is honest, Rona is steadfast, Rona follows through. It was almost as if neither one of us was complete, as if each one of us was lacking a few essential traits, a few really important playing cards for the game of life. And we were set up to be rivals. Meanwhile, Joyce, because she has such an affiliative nature, because she's so very gregarious, tended to feel rejected by me. She felt that unless we were each other's best friends, there was really something wrong with our relationship as sisters. She did not, she wanted me to be a different kind of person, a person I could never be. But she got to a point of in her life where she was happy for me to be me, and I was happy for her to be her. This is due in no small measure to the fact that we're now both over 50, and we're both conscious of mortality. Neither one of us would want to die with this unresolved, because let's face it, we are going to end up in the same place, whether we like it or not. My sister and I recently collaborated on a pair of essays for Moore magazine about our relationship, and we got a huge and heartfelt reaction. One of the reactions I got was from a friend of mine who told me, and I didn't know this about her, that she had also had a very fraught time with her sister, that her sister had told my friend, I don't want to speak to you anymore. And they didn't speak for a few years, and then the sister phoned and said, I'm dying of cancer. Now, how painful is that? The sister died before they could do the work that was necessary to build on strengths, and every pair of sisters does have some strengths.
How did she like the book?
She liked it very much. It was really gratifying. Because my sister's a fine writer. I sent it to her when it was finished, and I asked her to tell me if there was anything that really disturbed her. She, by the way, did the same for me when she published a memoir a number of years ago. And she told me it was a wonderful book. And there was only one thing that she brought up. And it was not a criticism. It was something that she thought I might like to add. And in the end, I did add it. She said, you say in your book that I did not attend your wedding, and that I didn't attend your wedding because of my schoolwork. And I said, yeah, that's right, I did say that. And she said, well, have you forgotten that I really wanted to attend your wedding and I was not allowed to come? And I had forgotten that. I was married in Toronto. My sister was in prep school in New Hampshire, and this prep school was very important to my mother. So my mother said, "You have to study. You can't come to the wedding." My mother almost didn't come to the wedding herself, but I made her come.
And you've been married now how long?
37 years next month.
Really?
And my mother didn't think he was good enough for me.
To close out our interview today, you open the book by describing that scene at her bedside just as she was dying. She had cancer, did she?
She had a brain tumor, and this amazing intellectual who lived by the word no longer could speak. She no longer could move. She lay there like a statue. And I would visit her and not know what to say. It was a nurse who told me the sense of hearing is the last to go. So just hold her hand and try talking to her about whatever comes into your mind. And I did that. I went into a meditative state. And I knew I wouldn't be interrupted, as she often had interrupted me during her life. So one day, I just said, and it came out of nowhere, you know, I'm kind of restless, and I think I'd like to be the editor of Chatelaine someday. what do you think? And I was not expecting an answer at all. I mean, she was, I thought, paralyzed by the tumor. But I was holding her hand, and ever so lightly, she squeezed my hand. She was telling me to go for it. It's an extraordinary irony when you come to think of it, and somebody pointed this out to me the other day, that words really were her medium. But the most important thing she ever said to me, she said without words.
This is a remarkable book, and I want to congratulate you on writing it, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about it. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask, one reviewer wrote that it was so well written that they wanted you to continue writing. Are you working on another book?
Not at the moment, but the doors in my mind are open, and maybe another book will walk in. I'm doing a lot of writing for my website, and maybe this will point in the direction of a book.
Well, Rona, thanks so much again for joining us.
Thank you.
Continued good luck with this book. The book is called My Mother's Daughter, a memoir, $34.99, published by McClelland & Stewart. I'm Joseph Plante.